Does it make my face glow? Let's pray. Father in heaven, Lord Jesus Christ, we come to you mindful of how we just worshiped you. Christ is the fountain, the deep, sweet well of love. And we've tasted streams of it here. We know we'll drink our fill when we see you as you are. And we look forward to that day. And yet, as we live now here on earth, we desperately need you. We need your Spirit to show us how to live. And we ask that you would use this time as your people have gathered together. We ask that you would give this time to you and ask that you would use it in our hearts and our understandings. Help us to think like you think. Change our thinking where we don't think as you want us to. Ask, Father, that you would guide me, guide my words, help them to come out well, to teach your truth. Ask, Father, that you would keep me from error. And I ask, Father, that then you would use it in the understandings and in the lives of everyone listening, that we would be changed more into the image of Jesus. We ask all this in Jesus Christ's name. Amen. Today we are going to be looking at one of the most difficult passages in the Gospels. I have it on good authority that it's one of the most difficult passages in the Gospels, because everybody who I looked up a commentary on this passage would say, and this is the most difficult passage in the Gospel of Luke, is where it's at. And so since everybody agrees that it's difficult, and nobody agrees exactly what it means, we're going to land that it is one of the most difficult passages in the Gospels. It's in Luke 16. This passage is difficult because in many ways we don't like it. It's difficult because in many ways it's more convicting than we wish it was, and it gets personal quicker than we wish it would. It's difficult because it doesn't sound like something Jesus should say. And it's finally difficult because we can't be sure that we're getting it absolutely correct when we go through it. And that is evidenced by the amount of people who have so many opinions that absolutely disagree on it. Because of that, I'm going to try to stay away from the specifics that cause most of the disagreements and focus on the overall general truths that are being presented that we can be a little more sure of. Luke 16, Jesus makes a statement. He says, make friends with wealth. Therefore, I say to you, make friends by your use of wealth. And that's a quick summary. And that doesn't really click with us. We think, no, that's not what we're supposed to do as Christians. We're supposed to make friends with the gospel. We're supposed to make friends with any number of things, with how we love one another, with even our outreaches as a church. But to use our money to make friends doesn't quite fit. Very well-known book in American culture, and a very old book, is How to Make Friends and Influence People. And the idea is how to make friends and influence people in order to gain wealth, in order to then use that wealth to make friends and more and influence more people in a very philanthropic way. So the idea of it is all good. And we say, well, that's a good thing, and there is a good use of wealth, and yet at the same time, is that our highest calling? And we're stuck with this dilemma as Christians. And Jesus actually speaks exactly to that and how to unwind the dilemma a little bit in this passage. And unfortunately, that's where it gets a little personal and a little sticky, but we're going to try to do it. We're going to go through this passage three times this morning. The first time, we're just going to read through it and make sure we understand and see what's there. The second time, we're going to look at some details, some specifics, and we're going to try to get a handle on what's included, what's said, and what's not said. And then we're going to go through it a third time and see how it actually applies to us. And I think we're going to like it when we get to the end. So, Luke chapter 16, we're going to look at verses 1 through 13. We'll read verses 14 and 15 at the very end, but 16, 1 through 13. Jesus also said to the disciples, "There was a rich man who was informed of accusations that his manager was wasting his assets. So he called the manager in and said to him, 'What is this I hear about you? Turn in an account of your administration, because you can no longer be my manager.' Then the manager said to himself, 'What should I do, since my master is taking away my position from me? I'm not strong enough to dig. I'm too ashamed to beg. I know what to do so that when I am put out of the management, people will welcome me into their homes.' So he contacted his master's debtors one by one. He asked the first, 'How much do you owe my master?' The man replied, 100 measures of olive oil. The manager said to him, 'Take your bill, sit down quickly, and write 50. Then he said to another, 'And how much do you owe?' The second man replied, 100 measures of wheat. The manager said to him, 'Take your bill and write 80. The master commended the dishonest manager because he acted shrewdly. For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their contemporaries than the people of light. And I tell you, make friends for yourselves by how you use worldly wealth, so that when it runs out, you will be welcomed into eternal homes. The one who is faithful in a very little is also faithful in much, and the one who is dishonest in a very little is also dishonest in much. If then you haven't been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will entrust you with true riches? And if you haven't been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money." I was reading that from the New English Translation. I realize that most of you probably don't use that translation, and for the most part I'll be using New American Standard for the rest of this message. But I wanted to do that just to get a little bit of a different thought on some of the verses. The problems. I want to bring up the problems. Why we stumble over this passage. And the first place we stumble over this passage and what makes it hard is verse 8. It says, this time from New American Standard, "And his master praised the unrighteous manager because he had acted shrewdly. For the sons of this age are more shrewd in relation to their own kind than the sons of light." What the problem is that Jesus tells a story, and in Jesus' story, the master, who we don't know quite who he represents, commends someone who is called dishonest for these dishonest actions. And that brings up all sorts of dilemmas. Is that Jesus saying that this guy actually did well in the situation? Is Jesus commending dishonesty in certain situations? Would Jesus do something like that? That's one of the dilemmas we're going to have in the passage. Another one is what I already brought up. Verse 9, Jesus says, directly following that, "And I say to you, make friends for yourselves by means of the wealth of unrighteousness, so that when it fails, they will receive you into eternal dwellings." Why would Jesus say to use something unrighteous and the wealth of unrighteousness? What could he possibly mean by that? What is he trying to say? Because once again, it feels like Jesus is pulling us somewhere outside of the holy lives we're used to and used to hearing him teach about, into some place that maybe we're a little uncomfortable with. So those are the two interpretational problems. There's a lot more applicational problems that are going to make it a little uncomfortable as we go. But the general idea is make friends using wealth. What does it mean, and how do we do it? So, we're going to go back through and look at it again. Looking over the parable, which it is, it's a parable, the story makes one major point, and we need to keep this in mind as we look at it. And here's the one point. It's wise to make friends with resources available to you while you have the opportunity. That's the main point. And we're going to go through the parable again and see if that fits. Where we get a little bit tripped up is when we try to make the parable say a little bit more than it's trying to say, and we try to get Jesus to say more than he's saying in the first part, and don't let him make his own applications at the end. But the main point, it's wise to make friends with resources available to you while you do have the opportunity. In verses 1 and 2, reading them again, this time in New American Standard, "He was also saying to the disciples, 'There was a rich man who had a manager, and this manager was reported to him as squandering his possessions. And he called him and said to him, "What is this I hear about you? Give an accounting of your management, for you can no longer be my manager." Some translations use the word steward. The idea is this is someone who speaks with his master's authority, has power over the money, keeps the books, all the things we would expect a manager or a steward to do. He was not being wise in the use of his master's resources, to an extent. He was not being maybe exactly forthright. He was not operating out of integrity in the use of his master's resources for his master. He was probably doing pretty well for himself. We don't know exactly how that works. Maybe the problem that the master had with him was that he was skimming too much off the top. Maybe the problem the manager had with him was that he was just lazy and not keeping good records. Either way, the manager says, "You're done. Turn it in. You know, go collect what you have. Bring it to me. You're done." The master confronts the steward or the manager, and the master thinks that the charges are true enough that right from the beginning he tells the steward, "You're already done. You don't have a chance out of this." We're going to go on. Verses 3 and 4. The manager, or steward, said to himself, "What shall I do, since my master is taking the management away from me? I am not strong enough to dig, and I am ashamed to beg. I know what I will do, so that when I am removed from the management, people will welcome me into their homes." So the steward or the manager sits down for a little bit. He understands he has limited time and limited options. And he doesn't answer the manager or the master when the master talks to him. This conversation is just to himself. It's when he's apart. He can see only two normal answers, and he rejects them both. The first one is, "Well, I could go dig." But basically the idea is, "I'm not strong enough. I'm white collar. I know I won't survive that life. I'm not willing to go there. I could beg. I'm also not willing to go there. That hurts my pride too much. So my limited options mean I've got to find a way to keep life as close to it is right now. And how am I going to do that?" And so he develops a plan. And we're not told exactly what the plan is in verses 3 and 4. We just know that the purpose of the plan. And the purpose of the plan is very important. In verse 4, the purpose of the plan: "I know what I shall do, so that when I am removed from the management, people will welcome me into their homes." The purpose is to get welcomed into homes once the current situation is over. And we don't quite know what he's thinking. There's some problems with this. What does he mean by being welcomed into homes? I'll bring up some things that we might think about a little later. If he's thinking he's going to get a new job because of this plan he hatches where he defrauds his master by giving it to these other people, he's totally wrong. Because no one knowingly hires Robin Hood to manage their expenses. So he clearly is not thinking, the people that I give this benefit to are going to hire me, because the people would look at that and say, "Well, we're really glad for the big write-off you gave us, but there's no way you're touching my books." So that's out. So he's also probably not saying, but maybe he is saying, "Maybe I just want a place to live." Maybe he's saying, "Maybe they'll just take me and I can just go and I'll incur enough favor that I can bounce from house to house and be a freeloader for a while." It's a possibility. It doesn't quite make sense. And the reason I bring up these options is I actually think it's wrong-headed to try to go there. I don't think that's the point of Jesus' story, is to try to take this parable and say, exactly what does he mean? He's trying to make a general point. And when we try to get too detailed, and we get lost in those details and we miss the main point. Verses 5 through 7, we'll call desperate times call for desperate measures. "And he summoned each one of his master's debtors, and he began saying to the first, 'How much do you owe my master?' And he said, 100 measures of oil. And he said to him, 'Take your bill and sit down quickly and write 50. Then he said to another, 'And how much do you owe?' And he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said to him, 'Take your bill and write 80. What's going on here? There's a few things we need to do. We need to get rid of the thought that he's talking about a checkbook. Checkbooks didn't exist. They're talking about measures of produce. So if someone owes 100 measures of wheat and he says, "Well, write me 50 now and I'll cancel the debt," that doesn't make sense. The person would have to bring in the 50 measures of wheat. And it just can't work. So there's something else happening there. Number two, the size of these debts is enormous. The size of the wheat debt would take approximately 3 to 5 years to work off at a normal man's working wages. The size of the oil debt would take 8 to 10 years to work off at a normal man's working wages. So these are people who are massively in debt to this master, and he's writing off massive amounts. We don't know. Yeah. We just know that much about it. And the listeners would have heard that as they originally listened to it. They know that these people are getting huge discounts on what they owe. Most likely the scenario is that at the time this is written, and we've got some archaeological evidence to indicate this, that the way the society worked was if you were in debt or you wanted to borrow, you would go to someone and you would write out your promissory note in your own hand. I owe 100 measures of wheat to this person, and you would sign it. And then the person who was owed would hold on to it. And they could say at any time, you still owe this. And so when you'd bring in a partial payment, you would come in and say, okay, here's 20. I now only owe you this much. And you would be allowed to write in your own hand what's still owed. And that way both sides have documentation and it's agreed on, because it's written in the other person's handwriting and the second person is holding it. Does that make sense? When this guy comes in and he brings these people in, he's allowing them to change what's written. He's changing the document. How he's doing that exactly, there's lots of theories on it. Some people say, well, he was just writing off his own commission. It's possible. I don't quite go with that, because it's after this that Jesus calls him unrighteous again. So I think this action was supposed to be looked on as unrighteous. It could be that he is knowingly defrauding his master and he's just making a way in for himself. It could be that he lost all of them. It could be that he doesn't quite know and he's just been, you know, he's just a terrible record keeper. And so he calls people in that he knows owe, and he says, how much do you owe? And they say this. He says, I'll let you write 80 now. And the person does it. And he's like, oh good, I got a record, I got something. And so he didn't have to start over. Either way, he's trying to cover his tracks. He's trying to make something good for himself. And what he's doing, he knows, is defrauding his master. Those are the big points. I want to comment a couple things. What he didn't do is very important. What he did not do is argue with the master. What he did not do is try to change the master's mind. What he did not do is pretend like nothing was different and just keep going on as if status quo continued until the master actually picked him up by his ears and tossed him out on the street. What he did not do is invest in little things to try to prolong the situation. What he did do was he used a short chance that he had to contact as many people as he could. He used the resources at his own disposal, which weren't his own, to make friends. He effectively cut ties with his old way of life. If he was in trouble already, he's in real trouble now. And he wasn't afraid of giving away large gifts of what he had at his disposal. He just kind of threw it around. Verse 8 starts getting more complicated. And the master praised the unrighteous manager because he had acted shrewdly, for the sons of this age are more shrewd in relation to their own kind than the sons of light. The master commended the steward because he acted prudently in the situation. Notice I changed the word. And I actually didn't. We have this idea of shrewd that it has a negative connotation And so he did a kind of a foxy thing. It's wise for himself, but bad. And it is from the context, wise for himself, but bad. But the word actually is the same word that's used in the Greek translation of the Old Testament all through Proverbs. Wisdom. He acted wisely. He acted prudently in the situation, said the master. So the master says, you acted as wisely as you could given this situation. That brings up some problems for us. We don't like it. We don't like that the master would commend him. We don't like it on a logical level. We don't like it on a theological level, maybe. We don't like that Jesus calls him unrighteous and yet still uses him as an example. I want to point something out that's going to become important later. The master is not Jesus and the master is not God. The master is a character in the story that Jesus is using to make a point. And he's not claiming to be the master. He's saying, in this situation, the master did this. It's kind of, I don't want to use that. It's kind of a power play type thought. Maybe it's that the master is coming in and saying, well, you really did good for yourself. You know, that hurt me even worse, but I have no record. You know, and maybe the master is commending him that way and kind of like through his teeth and saying, get out, you dirty, rotten, but I can't do anything better. I can't do anything to you. You covered your tracks well. Maybe that's it. And maybe that's the kind of praise it is. But we don't even know that. And it doesn't matter too much. We know that the master commends him for wisdom in his situation. And Jesus says, I've got a point to make from that. And we'll pick that up in a little bit. The point of the story, I guess we'll pick it up now, is that the steward acted prudently in his situation. This is the main point we're trying to get. To try to get more from it is where we get in trouble. To try to get more from it is where we start tripping over it. There's two kinds of people in the world, according to the end of verse 8. Sons of this age and sons of light. And this is why we don't really like it. Another reason why it hurts us is Jesus said, they're better. The sons of this age are better than you, sons of light. But no, they get it all wrong, Jesus. They don't use their money to further the kingdom. They use their money here on earth to further their stuff. And Jesus says, actually, they're acting more wisely than you're acting wisely. So, there's an application. And the application, and that's where we trip up. As soon as I say that, you kind of say, whoa, why would Jesus say that? In the context, the application is, given their understanding, they're living it out. Given our understanding, we're not. So, just like the man in the story knew it was time to cut ties, maybe we should too. That's where we're going with an application. We'll get there. We're being shown up by the world, and this is kind of what made us uncomfortable earlier. Verse 9 in NAS, I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of the wealth of unrighteousness, so that when it fails, they will receive you into eternal dwellings. Jesus gives the application of his, the practical application. The first application is, and the theological application is, they're better at living out their own theology. Then the practical application is, so you go make friends with your wealth. How do we do it? This term, wealth of unrighteousness, or worldly wealth, is something that needs understood. There's a couple points that we need to understand from it. One is that Jesus is not saying, is absolutely not saying, that wealth is unrighteous. He's not saying, go use this wicked stuff to use money, which is unrighteous. It's actually the opposite. What he's trying to do is we draw a line down our wealth. And so did people in Jesus' day. And he knows we do it. Religious people always do it. And we take our wealth, we take what God gives us, and we carve out a piece for God, and we say, God money. Or we put it in the God envelope, and we stick it over here, and then we say, mine. And what Jesus is saying, I'm glad you gave that away. Thank you for the gift you gave me. That part you're calling mine, your worldly wealth, your unrighteous wealth, the part that's not dedicated to God, I have instruction on how you use that. That's what we're going to talk about the rest of the time. And so Jesus is meddling, like only Jesus does, in how we use the stuff that we think is ours. Number two, mammon. I think the older King James Version, I know the King James Version, and I think the New King James, and I know the older New American Standard, used this word in verse 9 when it says, I tell you the truth, make friends for yourself, by how you use unrighteous mammon, or by your use of unrighteous mammon. And this is kind of one of the things that trips us up and has for a long time. The word is an Aramaic word. It means hand. And then when you use it as the way it's used in this context, it means what can be held with your hand. Well, it doesn't mean money. Why do we think it means money? It's kind of a punt. When you're translating and you get to a word that you don't know the exact definition of, you transliterate it, meaning you take the letters from the other language and you put them in the new language. And that's what happened when the King James was being translated many, many years ago, 1611 or before. And they came to this word, which was Aramaic and not Greek. They said, we don't know what it means. Well, let's transliterate it. It became mammon. And everybody knows from the context it has something to do with money. So we get used to the idea of it meaning money. And then we get to the later, we get to English translations, and actually it happened in the Old Testament, in the Greek translation of the Old Testament, in parts, they took the same thing and they transliterated it. And so, for multiple generations of copies of Scripture, we've got this Aramaic word that no one knows what it means, sitting there. And it gets all the way into English and King James, and we get used to it. And we think it means money, just because no one finds out. And then, a little bit through studies, they look back and say, oh, we know where this word is. It means hand. And what I want, why I'm making a point of that, he's not just talking about your money. He says, anything you can grasp, that's what we're talking about. Anything else, it's not just the 10% of your income you carve out, how you use what God has given you. In my case, money, I'm within the top 5% of richest people in the U.S. or in the world, and I know it. So I've got a lot of money. I've got some other resources. I've got kids that I can use to make friends with. I've got a house. I've got cars. I've got a lot of things I can use to make friends with. We're going to pick this up a little bit later. Another point from verse 9. Wealth will fail. I'm going to use the word wealth to summarize all these things that I could hold with my hand. Wealth will fail. And then after that, I will be received into heaven. There's not a comment on, and I think I had a misunderstanding of this passage several years ago when I even taught here on it. It's not a comment on who will receive. It's just saying, you'll be received. Into an eternal dwelling is how you're living corresponding to that idea that there will be an eternal place that you live that won't be here where you are now. So it's best to understand this phrase, they will receive you into eternal dwellings, as you will be received into eternal dwellings, which is how NET and I think NIV takes it as well. Verse 4 has a very close parallel to verse 9. I just want to point out really quickly. In 16:4, he says, I know what I will do so that when I am removed from the management, people will welcome me into their homes. Verse 9, Jesus says, make friends for yourselves by means of the wealth of unrighteousness, so that when it fails, they will receive you into eternal dwellings. One is removed from management, so that when I'm removed from this, and then the other one is when earthly wealth fails. The second one is they'll receive me into their homes, they'll receive me into heavenly dwellings. What makes them parallel is the structure in Greek, which doesn't matter too much what it is. The words and the tenses are exactly the same. All that switched is two nouns. Every word matches all the way through. And Jesus wants us to bring up, and he says, what I want you to get out of this is what he did and his thinking. It's going to end. I've got to prepare for the future, is what you need to think. It's going to end. I've got to prepare for the future. Verses 10 through 12. He who is faithful in a very little thing is faithful also in much. He who is unrighteous in a very little thing is unrighteous also in much. Therefore, if you have been faithful in the use of unrighteous wealth, who will entrust true riches to you? And if you have not been faithful in the use of that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth. In verse 10, Jesus' point is faithfulness and unrighteousness are the exact same thing, whether it's big or small, whether you're dealing with big things or little things. This includes faithfulness in making friends. This includes faithfulness in the means used to make friends. Verse 11 is an example, and the first example Jesus gives, so number one example, of a little thing to be faithful in, meaning worldly wealth, so that we don't get it wrong in the big things. There is in verse 11, he says, therefore, if you have not been faithful in the use of unrighteous wealth, who will entrust true riches to you? There is a true riches of which worldly wealth is a little thing in comparison. Verse 12 is a reason to be faithful. it's not really yours. Verse 12 says something the exact opposite of what we always think. When it says, if you have not been faithful in the use of that which is another's, who will give you your own? My thought is, if you don't take care of your dog, your car, I'm not going to let you borrow mine. I say to my kids, if you don't take care of, and I use a pet analogy, but it'll never happen in my house, but if you don't take care of the goldfish, you're not going to get a cat. Well, that's how we think. Jesus says, no, it's mine. If you're not faithful in my stuff, who says I'm ever going to give you something of your own? Verse 13. You cannot serve God and wealth. What we need to get out of that, wealth is a master, just like God is a master. That's where we miss it. We think that we can serve God and wealth a lot of times. But wealth, Jesus says, no, it's if you turn to serve wealth as a master, you aren't serving God as a master. They pull in opposite directions so that you can't serve both. Your loyalty will show itself. Jesus ends it with, if you're devoted to God, you will despise wealth. If you're devoted to wealth, you will despise God. The word means to treat with contempt, or even better, to consider something of little value. And this is how it works out in my life. If I am only thinking of God, the wealth becomes of less value. I don't make my decisions based on that. The monetary decisions and how that works doesn't matter. God's told me to do this, and people say, well, that's the worst use of your money, to give it to this thing or to do that. Well, I don't really see how that has anything to do with it. I'm focusing on Jesus. But if I'm focused on the wealth, then I tend to despise and think little of what I hear Jesus whispering, of you should do things this way. When wealth is prized, God is treated as having little value, and vice versa. So in applications, we've gone through the interpretation, and I've already made some, but we're going to get a little more specific. Go back through and how it applies specifically to us. In verses 1 through 7, the parable itself, there's one main point. It's wise to make friends with the resources available to us while we have the opportunity. Verse 8, where Jesus starts the applications, the master commended the dishonest manager because he acted shrewdly, for the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their contemporaries than the people of light. I already said this, there's two kinds of people in this world, and we're getting shown up by the other ones. That's Jesus' point. How? Why? Because we give ours to God and they don't. We're not committed, here's how, to using our resources to further what we know to be true as much as they're committed to using their resources to further what they know to be true. Can you follow that? They say, all I've got is now. I'm going to spend it on me. We say, all I've got is Jesus. And I'm going to spend it on me. And it doesn't make sense. They're better. Here's another way we're shown up. They're better at making friends with their wealth, with their possessions, than we are. And here's where it gets even more touchy than it was before. But too often, they have no trouble inviting people into their home, saying, hey, what's mine is yours, and they don't really mean it. But come on over, you know, let's watch a game together, let's do these things, and they become friends. We, unfortunately, don't get into the world and we don't make friends very well. And part of that is because we've got a meeting almost every night of the week. Or we think, what will my church friends think if they see me with? Or the only time I use my wealth is under these circumstances because I don't want the other people to think poorly of me, and I just never make friends. And I know that's touchy. It's a little scary when we think it through. We use the excuse that we're using our money for God, not for people, not just to win friends. We use the excuse of being too busy with God and God things to really take the time to make friends. Jesus says in verse 9, and I tell you, make friends for yourselves by how you use worldly wealth or wealth of unrighteousness, so that when it runs out, you will be welcomed into eternal homes. This is Jesus' specific command from the story. What might it look like? Give them to the poor. That's easy. helping the poor. Maybe giving to someone to gain an audience to share the gospel. That's easy. We're going to go a little further. Those are the easy ones. The use of wealth and the ability to continue to use wealth and the benefits of using wealth will end. That's Jesus' point. Someday you won't have it to share like you do now. This use time is going to end. But one benefit of having used the wealth will continue. And so I want to go through, I pointed out a parable between verses 4 and 9 before, that there's this idea of cutting ties. I want to make a parallel between what the steward knew and acted and what a disciple knows and would act. The steward knew that his time and his present situation was short. Disciples have been told this as well. The steward could have tried to continue living as if nothing had changed and the conversation never happened. Disciples face the temptation to continue living as if the situation will not change. The steward could have invested his effort in maintaining the current situation in order to keeping change from happening. Disciples face the temptation to invest in the current system and try to ignore that changes might happen. The steward used the short chance he had to contact people while he could. Disciples should get started at making friends while they can. The steward used resources at his disposal to make friends. Disciples are tempted to use resources in other ways. The steward effectively cut ties with the old way of life. Disciples face temptation to not be too drastic. The steward was not afraid of large gifts of the resources currently at his disposal. Disciples face the temptation to save most resources for an upcoming emergency, even though they've been told that wealth will fail. There's a really important note of clarification, and I've already made it. I talked about what mammon means, and it's not just money, it's everything. And I talked about that Jesus said, unrighteous mammon, not just the part I give to God, but the rest. And that's where this comes out, and it becomes not convicting and not a guilt message, but a freeing message. Jesus is offering freedom like only Jesus offers it. And that's the point of this. He's saying, that part that you spend all your time thinking about, can I give you a little handle on it? What if when you're out doing these things and you encounter whatever, your thought is, how can I make friends with what I've got? So I've given my whatever I give before the Lord that we've worked out, that's the right amount that I give to the Lord. But then I'm going to the gas station and I see, and whatever it is. Or I'm at the store and I see, and whatever it is. How would Jesus want me to use this now? And the biggest resource that we're probably talking about, and the biggest thing we clutch at, is our time, not our money. It's the biggest thing we try to hold on to. Jesus says, what about when you're out with, would you take the time to talk to if I put him in your way? What about when you're doing, would you take the time to, and we find out that, wow, Jesus is really getting in there. And he's poking us. Well, I didn't think he was going to talk about that. I thought I was just talking about money. The point in this passage is a welcome into heaven. Do I live this life as if I will be welcomed into heaven? Do they correspond? One day I will be. I'm sure of it. One day you will be. You're sure of it. And if we know we're going to be welcomed into heaven, Jesus says when he's in Matthew 25, quick summary, he separates the nations before him as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. It's not hard for me to tell sheep from goats. And it's really not hard for a shepherd. And Jesus has no trouble just saying, you're there, you're there. And when they ask, why are we here? Jesus says, because of how you took care of my people. How you gave a cup of cold water. It was obvious to me who you were. In the same way, we get tripped up on this. Verse 10. The one who is faithful in very little is faithful also in much. The one who is dishonest in very little is dishonest also in much. What does this mean? The end does not justify the means. That's what it means. Don't be unfaithful in the little things. This includes being faithful in the command to make friends. This includes being faithful in the way we make friends. We said that earlier. A son of light should properly understand that wisdom or prudence for him would not involve the same action as the steward in the story. Verse 11. If you then haven't been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will entrust you with true riches? And if you haven't been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you your own? We already said this. There is a true riches coming to which this is going to look like nothing. This is the opposite of the way we think, partially because we've never really experienced anything that's our own. I've never had anything that's my own. The closest I can come to is my kids. And I had to give them to the Lord and know they're not my own. So what have I ever actually had that's mine? Nothing yet. And that's Jesus' point. Verse 13. You cannot serve God and wealth. No servant can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the other one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money. We said wealth is a master just like God is a master. They pull in opposite directions. I may spend a lot of time trying to convince myself that I am the master. But that is not an option Jesus gives me. But we bind that. I say, there's people who are mastered by money, and they just spend all their time enslaved to money. That's not me. I'm the master of my money. I use it prudently. I use money as my servant. That's not one of the options Jesus gives. Jesus says, money is the master, or wealth is the master, or I am. And if you think that you're the master here in the middle, which is a lie American evangelicalism kind of buys into way too often, then it might just find out that it's a tricky way of still being mastered by your money, because you're still spending your time thinking about how to stay on top of it and how to get it all here, rather than turning to God and saying, I choose to think little of that compared to how I think of you. Am I saying throw away the 401k and all your assets and everything else like that? No. Then you'll have nothing to make friends with. I'm saying listen to Jesus and let Him guide how you use this. And sometimes to a lot of the world it'll look like you despise. You think so little of your money. You throw it away. You let that person borrow your whatever. Do you not value your possessions? Not as much as I value Jesus. It turns out that Jesus isn't using this passage to add pile on guilt. He's doing what Jesus does, and he's offering freedom. And he says to those who are a little bit enslaved and don't know it, I can set you free. How about you serve me? And you'll find out that my yoke is easy and my burden is a lot lighter than that was. So come follow me. Don't spend your time worrying, being enslaved to that. Let me give you freedom. Verses 14 and 15, really quickly, I said I'd end with it. The Pharisees, who loved money, heard all this and ridiculed him. But Jesus said to them, you are the ones who justify yourselves in men's eyes. But God knows your hearts, for what is highly prized among men is utterly detestable in God's sight. Jesus' take on that, two aspects. When you despise Jesus' teaching here, you might be saying more about yourself than you are about the teaching. And you're aligning yourselves with those who clearly did hold on to money and love it. Number two, Jesus says, maybe your motives aren't the money itself that you love, but the people's approval when you have the wealth. He says, so maybe you need to turn and look to me, and maybe I'll set you free to use your wealth and give you more, but if that's your goal, then you're going to miss it. But if your goal is me and you find yourself despising it, then it won't matter how much you have. And maybe you'll have a whole lot to despise. And maybe you won't have much to despise. You'll be despising it anyway as you cling to Him. Two cautions to always be remembered when we're dealing with this. I want to be careful to guard against the thought that in any way we can purchase our own forgiveness, our own pardon from sins. The only way we're ever forgiven and the only entrance we have into heaven is Jesus and His payment. On the other hand, we need to be careful against shutting our eyes to the idea that Jesus presents real clearly there is something to do with how we use wealth here and a reception in heaven. There is repayment. And we can't miss it. If I don't want to be a slave of wealth, I have to be a slave of God. Worldly wealth will fail. When it does, will my use of it here be an indication of my reception into an eternal dwelling? Lord Jesus, thank You for giving us an indication of one more way You'd love to set us free. Thank You for being so patient with us as You continuously work to set us free. And as we get things wrong and we get distracted, and then You once again remind us that You're offering freedom and we can't serve You and anything else. So help us to choose You. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.